Please be seated.
Mr. Page.
Thank you.
Your final round of questions. Yep.
Yes. Sorry, there was... I have two topics which should be done and dusted inside 10 minutes.
Okay.
Mr. De Pelsmaker, on page 28 of your evidence in chief, you discuss the reasons why you don't consider that a review power under section 128 of the Act is a sufficient way to impose limits that might be approved under the Land and Water Regional Plan. You have that?
Yes, correct. Yep.
Page 28 or paragraph 28?
Sorry. Page 28, ma'am.
Page 28, okay.
It starts at paragraph 89.
Yep. Rinkidoki.
And you are concerned that under section 131, the council on a review has to have regard to the viability of the consented activity, right?
Correct.
And that might constrain the efficacy of a section 128 review in implementing limits.
Correct.
Doesn't the same issue arise under section 104(2) capital A of the Act, where a consent authority must have regard to the investment of the existing consent holder?
Which section was that?
104(2) capital A, ma'am. So whichever path you follow, a consent under section 104 or a review under section 128, you bump into the same issue.
Correct. Oh.
Yeah.
Yep.
Now, it is the council's operative policy to impose limits and catchments through a section 128 review process, isn't it?
Correct.
And that's policy 6.4.5 of the operative regional plan at Common Bundle page 89. Can we go to that?
Yes.
You have that?
That's policy 6.4.5.
Correct.
Yeah.
You have that?
Yes.
Good. Nearly at the bottom of page Common Bundle 89. So we have there the minimum flows established under the policies specified there will apply to resource consents to the taking of water as follows. I mean, that's fairly directive language, isn't it? Will apply as follows.
Correct.
First, we don't need to worry about today. Mm-hmm. In the case of takes applied under after 28th of February on the granting of consent. Secondly, there is a list of catchments starting with the Tyree, above Payrow in between Sutton and Outram, Welcome Creek, Shag, Kakanui, Water of the Leith, Lake Hayes, Waitahuna, Trotters, Waianakarua, Pomahaka, Waiwera, Lake Tuaki Toto, as defined in Schedule 2A, on a review under Section 128.
Correct.
And we know, don't we, that a whole of catchment section 128 review has been completed for Waianakarua, Pomahaka and Waiwera.
I am definitely aware of Pomahaka and Waiwera.
What was the last one?
Waianakarua, Pomahaka and Waiwera.
Yep.
So you're not aware that that's been done for Waianakarua?
No, I was not.
Okay. Then we come to 6.4.5C, and there is, we see the Luggett catchment area and Manuhirakia upstream of Ophir. and also a number of parts of the Tairi catchment.
Yes.
Again, we see that the council will impose minimum flows under section 128.
Correct.
The Luggett's already been done, hasn't it, because it's been completely reconsented?
Correct.
The council, in exercising policy 645, hasn't experienced the constraints you're concerned about in your evidence, has it?
No, but if I may add to that, my recollection about the Pomahaka and the Waiwera were both catchments where when we set the minimum flows, there was no issue around allocation. They were not, those catchments had, did not have the same level of pressure, as I may put it that way, as Manaharakia or some yes. central Otago catchments.
So you're expecting drier catchments, if I can put it that way, imposing minimum flows might be a little more contestable?
I would expect the impact of minimum flows in those catchments on the access or the reliability of water to be, have bigger impacts, yes.
Yeah, okay. So that might tell us something about the scale of the job, but it is council's policy to do that catchment by catchment by a review of all of the permits in the catchment at the same time. That's what it does.
That's been the practice, yeah.
Now I'm going to come to the Fan Change 7 text, policy 10A.2.3, and this is the version, I think we call it the 4 March version. Now, do you have, do you have 10, policy 10A.2.3 in front of you?
Correct.
And do you recognise this as being the policy that is implemented by the non-complying activity rule?
Correct.
Now, you know, don't you, that non-complying activities come with a jurisdictional barrier in section 104 capital D of the Act?
Yes.
And there is a policy gateway and an effects gateway.
Correct.
And the effects gateway is formulated as being no more than minor effects on the environment.
Correct.
And we see in policy 10A.2.3A, the policy also has the same gateway, no more than minor effects. See that?
Yes.
Is it your understanding that the consequence of the policy being drafted in that way is that if you fail the effects gateway in 104D, you also fail the policy gateway under 10A.2.3 subparagraph A.
Correct.
What is served by that?
The intent of the policy is to provide that gateway for activities that have no more than minor effect.
(Clears throat)
the rationale being that it is more appropriate to grant 15-year consents for activities that we are certain about that they don't have more than minor adverse effect.
Okay. When you are talking about no more than minor adverse effect, what is the environment that you have in mind in the drafting of that? Is it the environment absent the permits being renewed, or is it the baseline environment as defined by the NPS?
The environment. The first one.
Yeah. You remember from the debate from the Lindis, we called it the Ngāti Rangi naturalised environment, didn't we?
Yes.
And is that what you have in mind that this relates to? That the no more than minor effects test is the Ngāti Rangi naturalised environment absent the permits that are being renewed?
Or any activities, I guess, that would be present within that environment that would continue for a certain amount of time.
Yeah. So it's not a completely non-human environment, it's only the permits that are subject of the application which are absent from it. Is that what you mean?
Subject to the application or that are deemed to expire within a short amount of time, yes.
Well, we know, don't we, from the way that applications have been coming into the council, that they're coming in on a whole of catchment basis, aren't they? Arrows come in as a catchment, Cardrona, Manahatakia, Strathtyre. You've got whole catchment applications coming in being dealt with. Yeah? So if the environment for a whole catchment that is being considered under policy 10A.2.3A is absent any of the water take permits that exist in that catchment, how could any application possibly pass that test?
The the non-complying activity status was envisioned to provide for activities that have really small effects, where we would be certain.
Well, can I pause you there?
Yeah.
When you say really small effects, compared with what? Compared with the status quo or the baseline, as the NPS calls it, or compared with the Ngāti Rangi environment?
No, it would be with the first one.
Sorry, I've forgotten which the first one was.
The environment that would be naturalised plus any activities that would be...
So you are intending that test is the Ngāti Rangi test in that policy, absent the permits that are being applied for.
Correct.
When we return to the conversation that we had this morning about the implementation of the first tier of Objective 2.1 of the NPS and the ability of applications to impose limits that have the effect of delivering Tier 1, don't you think that there should be a merits pathway to allow such proposals to be considered under the NPS?
The effect of the pathway being longer-term consents.
Yeah. Because it's going to cost a lot of money for new infrastructure to give effect to those limits, isn't it? It's a bit like Lindis. Are you expecting tens of millions of dollars to be spent on a six-year permit to give effect to limits?
Well, the limits haven't been set yet.
No. But that's what I'm saying. If the applicants can put in place limits to protect Tier 1, why can't we have a merits process to test those rather than bump into a jurisdictional barrier under Section 104.1D where those merits may never get to be tested?
Sorry, so that... Put that question again. I didn't quite catch the second half.
So, if a proposal can impose limits that protect Tier 1 values, why can't that be considered without bumping into a jurisdictional barrier under Section 104D, which could lead to the merits of those limits never being tested? Because it's a jurisdictional barrier.
And this is the effects
limb? Yes, that's the effects point number.
Okay.
Two considerations. One is that to your freshwater visions process, you also come up with time frames for achieving limits mm-hmm. that haven't been set yet. The risk is that if you grant longer term consents through that pathway you're alluding to, you're going to miss that deadline.
Well, you may not, because you've got a Section 128 review power.
Yes, but the review clause, like I said before, it hasn't really been tested in heavily allocated catchments. Secondly, as I outlined in my evidence as well, there are some limits to it. For example, and I do not want to scare mongrel, but you cannot cancel a consent. Mm-hmm. Especially when you're looking at clawing back on allocations as well. A minimum flow is a temporary restriction, whereas an allocation is a ongoing a limitation on your consent. So the financial implications of that would be different. And the section, the consideration of section 131 could have a different outcome.
Yeah, okay. So your concern is the ability to implement target attribute limits if a consent's granted. Your concern is that Section 128 mightn't get you there.
Correct.
But we will know, won't we, when the RPS is notified, what council's date for achieving the target attribute limits and permits is going to be.
proposed date.
Yeah.
So it still has to go through a fresh freshwater planning process.
But the counterfactual, let's suppose that your concern carries weight. The counterfactual that there is a future risk that Section 128 mightn't be effective at imposing attribute targets is that we impose none now.
Sorry, could you repeat it? I think I missed one.
Yeah. Your concern is that if we grant long-term permits now under the non-complying activity rule, so let's say it's 15 years,
mm-hmm.
council's ability to impose target attribute limits under the NPS is not going to be effective under Section 128. That's your concern, right?
Yes.
What I'm putting to you is that the counterfactual is this. For the next 6 years, there are no limits at all. And so isn't that an environmental risk that can be managed through the consenting process, at least in the meantime? So the risk isn't entirely one way, is it? Mm.
There are some risks, but under the plan change, there is no framework, holistic or a comprehensive framework to deal with them. And like I mentioned before, the plan change has a limited lifespan, and to some degree, once the land and water plan is notified, or the RPS as well, we can start making progress on that front.
Well, here's a proposition for you. Is there anything in the language of policy 10A.2.3 that wouldn't just as logically lead to a fully discretionary activity status for permits that up to 2035?
Potentially.
So you're looking at the language of policy 10A.2.3
Correct.
For clues about why that necessarily leads to a non-complying activity status instead of a discretionary status? And you say there's something there?
It's a difficult question. If you're asking if a discretion, if you could provide for longer term consents as a discretionary activity, or under a discretionary activity pathway. It is something that I am happy to contemplate, but I would like to think it through.
Okay.
And I would like to, I wouldn't want to be wed to those specific words as well.
Sure.
Yeah.
I think we all are probably in that space. Let me put a proposition to you which explains the problem from Mo Rugg's point of view. You know that about 90% of the applications that have been lodged are for non-complying activities. Your own data tells us that.
Yeah.
The point at which the jurisdictional barrier under Section 104D is tested is in the decision, in the decision maker's decision, isn't it? So we go to a hearing, we present our evidence, decision maker makes a decision and decides whether the jurisdictional barrier is passed. That's how it works, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that's all going to be after the 1st of October this year.
I'm not following this. Also, we're well over 10 minutes, so how long do you need to wrap
this
it up?
This is my last question.
Last question, so I'm not following the question. Yeah. The proposition is that this council will not decide the applications lodged before 1 October. Is that the proposition?
That's the proposition.
That's assuming that there is no decision from this court before 1 October, which is a decision that is a controlled activity rule, which is, you know, I think where the council is now going and where several parties want it. So obviously different to what your client wants, I think, but I'm not certain now your client wants permitted activity. You know, if the case narrows, why do you think there wouldn't be one way or the other, permitted or controlled? Why do you think there would not be a decision? I've already indicated we will use all of our resources to get a decision out as soon as we can.
Yes, your decision, ma'am, you've indicated will be before then, but the council still has applications for non-complying activities on its books.
Yeah, so. If the decision, let's put it this way, if the decision is controlled activity, and that plan becomes operative, assuming there's no challenges to the High Court, as a controlled activity rule, then the applications are processed as a controlled activity, are they not? I can't see how White Section 88A would attach to say, perversely, oh, well, you were non-complying and you remain non-complying even though the operative rule is controlled. That would be a really perverse outcome, I would have thought, in the circumstances. But anyway, the outcome is easy to get around.
That contemplates, ma'am, that the non-complying activity rule disappears.
Well, yeah, that's true. And so there could be another... There could be a non-complying activity rule in relation to the same or a different policy, and I think a different policy, which is now under contemplation, as the Regional Council has said. Whether it retains the structure, who knows?
So my proposition...
What is your proposition? Because now becomes really quite theoretical, and I'm wondering what I'm going to do with it.
Well, it's important because there are unintended consequences at play here in my submission.
You need to get to the point more quickly than what you're doing.
Okay. Yeah. Let's suppose that there is still a non-complying activity pathway that, in the court's decision. And so the applications on foot still have to be determined as a non-complying activity, right? And let's suppose that those applications are decided after the 1st of October when the deemed permits expire. If, under Section 104D, a decision maker decides that there is no jurisdiction to grant those applications, then all the water is lost and there's no opportunity to reapply, is there?
Sorry, I don't understand the question. I'm not following the theory at this point. Why wouldn't there be jurisdiction to consider a non-complying activity if there was a rule in the plan to that effect?
Because the 104D barrier may not be passed, and we won't know whether the 104D barrier is passed until we've got a decision in hand.
So the proposition is you apply for resource consent. The activity status is it's Section 104D.
Yes.
Yeah, and so that's the applicant's proposition. And the decision maker says And presumably the applicant will be saying, well, we'll pass, you know, through both or one or t'other of the gate, you know, of the threshold tests. And you won't know till you get a decision. Okay, got that.
That's right. And so if 1 October has passed, when that decision is in hand, the controlled activity pathway is not available because it only is available to those with current permits. Because the permits expire. Sorry, this is a submission now rather than a question for the...
Well, it is, and I think it's completely hypothetical. Well, and maybe it is actually better left for submission. So you're saying that if you are an applicant, if you're currently a deemed permit holder, you apply for resource consent for a non-complying activity and you are unsuccessful and are declined consent, then, well, you no longer have a consent or permit. Is that what you're saying?
That's right.
All right, yeah, that's right. That's a, you know, that might be right, and that might be the risk for going down that that activity pathway. Maybe. Don't know. I need to hear from council, but yes. But that would pertain to absolutely everybody seeking to renew a resource consent who are in that position. Everybody. There's a risk. The thing is, when you apply to renew an application for resource consent, there's no guarantee you're going to get it. Isn't that the law? It's nothing that this council's doing. No, it's just the law.
That's right, ma'am. But the problem that's unique to permit holders is that the controlled activity pathway is only available to them for so long as their permits are on foot. This plan change has come so late in the process that it's an all-or-nothing choice. You apply for a non-complying activity if you want a longer-term consent because you've got a lot of money to spend on infrastructure, but if you don't get it, you cannot go back and apply under the controlled activity pathway because your permit has expired. And that's it. That's game over. No more order.
That might be the operation of the statute, which problem it is Parliament's. And to which your client's response is use Section 124 in a way which arguably is ultra vires the Act, which is, you know, one of the legal issues that we flagged, that you need to consider the position in law about, you know, about that particular relief.
Well, my submission, it is a consequence of the Act, but the real problem here is the timing of this plan change. If we were here a year ago, I wouldn't be making this submission because there would be time enough to test the pathways and go back to controlled activity if we can't get through the barrier. But that time has gone. The applications have to be in by the end of this month, and it's inevitably going to take beyond the expiry date of the permits to have them substantively considered. I mean, we're working every day with the council staff and contractors on how they're processing these applications.
Yes, no, I understand that. I do think it's a matter best left for submission, and it's a matter which is really goes to the basis of the application. You could bring yourself within the controlled activity rule, whatever that ends up being, but you could bring yourself within that, or you take the riskier pathway of it being declined under Section 104D. So perhaps I haven't yet understood what you're saying, how that arises apart from the operation of the Act. Isn't that the stick and carrot approach of this plan?
Well, it's not clear to me that the Regional Council have understood the consequences of the non-complying activity pathway.
That you may be declined your resource consent?
We may not have an opportunity if we are not able to get through the 104D gateway to go back to the controlled activity pathway. We will not have that opportunity.
Well, I suppose you could always make an application on two bases, couldn't you? Just say, isn't that the answer? You either or, you know, and the decision maker will go this way or that. I mean, it's unedifying if I was a decision maker, you know, but isn't that the response? You bring yourself and you give the decision maker the opportunity to consider the substantive merits of the proposal as it is non-complying, or you say, failing that, let's go for controlled and tick it over for another 5 years. And that's accepting that there are risks to the environment. There must be. There's some talk about that in this hearing, but there must be continuing risks to the environment.
Yes.
Now, that's not lost on us. The determination will go, how do you weigh, you know, the relative risks, you know, between the different parties' outcomes?
Yes.
That, I think, gets weighed under, not under Tier 1, but under Te Manawatū Wai, the foundational principle. That is a matter for legal submissions, which I can signal later.
Mm.
So
right.
I don't know how far you want to take this, because
we've explored that now.
You can ask this witness, does he not understand that you could be declined resource consent under Section 104D? You can ask him that.
Well,
but I think it doesn't matter what he thinks, we know that.
Of course the witness understands that he'd be declined on 04D.
Yeah.
It's the consequence of
yes.
that decision that the water is no longer available to be allocated is the kicker.
And there seems to me that there is a pathway through that where you can, the fallback position is take it as a controlled. If you're not successful on the merit, you take it as a controlled. And Mr. Moore's nodding as if this is, well, that sounds like a good idea. So, you know, there's a, you know.
Yes.
So that you are managing your risk, and it's all about risk management, particularly for farmers. You're managing your risk. If you're unsuccessful this way, council can still consider it as a control, because after all, the council is not wanting to turn off farming, and it's made that really clear.
And I accept that, Mum. My client's concern is that the law of unintended consequences may apply, and that is exactly what might happen. And
what's
so,
that they switch off farming?
Well, there's no ability. If we don't get through the 104D gateway test after the 1st of October, it's game over.
Well, I do, you know, we can have Mr. Moore respond to that, having taken his client's instructions, but I can't see what would preclude... would preclude the consideration of the application of two alternate bases, given particularly that this council does not want to do anything other than preserve the historic position of farmers going forward.
Yes.
If that is its position, why would it not accept an application on two bases? Provided, you know, you bring yourself under the rule,
yes.
properly under the basis. Now, Mr. Moore can take his client's instructions and he can get back to you about that. But
I'll leave it at that point and sit down.
Okay, all right. All right, re-examination. No. Oh, territorial authorities, we are really not running to time. So you've got half an hour.
Yes.
Yep.
Only got a few topics to discuss with Mr. De Pelsmaker. So, Mr. De Pelsmaker, I'd like to start with discussing the various functions that the Regional Council has under the Act, which are set out in Section 30. So you would agree with me that the council has functions related to the allocation and controls on the taking and use of water?
Yes.
That they have a function to establish and implement provisions to ensure sufficient development capacity?
Yes.
And they also have a function to establish and implement provisions that achieve integrated management of
yep.
natural and physical resources.
Yes.
And when we talk about integrated management in the context of regional councils, would you agree that's both amongst the various functions that the regional council holds, but also functions that are administered by the regional council and other territorial authorities?
Yes.
At paragraph 110 of your rebuttal evidence, you talk about Plan Change 7 being the best way forward for managing fresh water and ensuring Te Mana o Te Wai is achieved.
Correct.
You don't refer there to the other functions that the Regional Council has. It's a focus on your fresh water functions.
Correct.
Now, the evidence filed on behalf of the territorial authorities, particularly that of Ms. McGurr and Mr. Greenwood, discusses how Plan Change 7 is likely to compromise their ability to meet their requirements to provide development capacity and provide safe drinking water supplies. You've read that evidence?
Yes, I have.
And so I put it to you that Plan Change 7 doesn't appropriately serve the various functions that the Regional Council has under the Act.
I believe it does. When considering the evidence from Ms. McGurr, Mr. Greenwood, Mr. Twos as well, I looked at the other functions that you refer to of regional councils, integrated management, and also providing for development capacity. And I also looked at the national policy statement, because in the end, that is probably, like, at the moment, the leading document.
This is the urban development.
Sorry, yes, national urban development one. Yeah. Sure. I went through the objectives and policies and asked myself the same question that you just posed me. And to me, there are a number of objectives and policies in there that actually point towards the fact that giving effect to the other responsibilities can better be done through the land and water plan. I also looked at the obligation to meet various, to develop various strategies and things like that. I looked at the timing of Plan Change 7, the timing of the requirement for territorial authorities to develop future development strategies, which I believe is in 2024 or something, yeah. And I actually thought that it all hangs well together. We've got our new land and water plan, which is going to be notified in 2023, that can inform the future development strategies that need to be done by 2024. At the same time, there are things such as housing and business development capacity assessments that need to be done by territorial authorities, but to my understanding haven't been done yet. They need to be done this year. So I think through Plan Change 7, given that it's an interim planning framework, we cannot appropriately give effect to these requirements because the baseline work hasn't been done. It's a short-term interim plan change. It's not a long deferral. Also, going back to the objectives and the policies, the first objective actually talks about...
Sorry, which document are you referring to?
The NPS UD. The end goal there is a healthy and safe environment, to put it in my own words. I think that is also the end goal of the NPS for fresh water. It's more appropriate that councils tries to provide for these through one planning framework that is developed at the same time.
So I think both Ms. McGuire and particularly Mr. Greenwood discussed projects that councils have on foot now to provide water supply or obtain access to safer, more reliable water, and expressed concerns about how six-year terms could compromise the delivery of those projects. Does that not create an issue in achieving the objective of the NPSUD that you just referred to?
The first priority is still giving effect to the health and the first priority is making sure that freshwater bodies and associated ecosystems are healthy.
Are we talking now about the national policy statement for freshwater?
For freshwater management. So providing for the drinking, for the health and well-being of people is subordinate on that. In that regard, I think a short-term time frame for those activities is the most appropriate way forward.
Okay, I won't pursue that any further.
Thank you.
Secondly, I just want to talk to you about, the second priority in the freshwater NPS, which is obviously about providing for the health needs of people.
Yeah.
And refers to drinking water as being an example of that. I want to discuss what we mean by drinking water. So if we take a community water supply scheme. They generally take water, goes to a reservoir or into a treatment plant and gets treated to the drinking water standards and distributed. So that is all drinking water, isn't it?
Well, it is treated to a standard to a drinking water standard.
Yes.
It is not all used as drinking water, is my understanding.
Right. So once it has been treated and is sent out into the distribution network, how do we decide when it is drinking water and when it is not drinking water?
I guess that depends on the end user.
And how do we figure that out? How does the network know?
When I read the evidence, I believe, if I recall correctly, that it would be very difficult to distinguish.
Once it's been treated and being
Correct.
Distributed.
Yes.
And so that presents a challenge, doesn't it, when we are applying the Schedule 10A method?
Correct.
And so how do you propose we fix that?
I thought that was the matter for conferencing next week. I'm not sure whether, if you haven't considered it, you should say so, but
no.
I thought you guys were conferencing that.
We can leave that till then.
Hmm?
We can leave that till then.
Yeah.
I don't know if Mr. De Pelsmaker was participating in the conference.
I don't know that he was. Although, and in fact, I was expecting a memo about that this morning, but I haven't seen it yet. And I thought maybe planners and technical people were going to be there. That's what I think I was told by Mr. Cooper late last night. But we haven't seen the memo, so we, yeah.
Okay. No, I'm happy to leave that,
okay.
And I can circle back if the conferencing doesn't appropriately address it. But let's leave it there for now.
Your people will be there.
Mm-hmm. Pardon?
Your people are going to be there.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I'm going to leave it there, Your Honour.
All right. Okay. Re-exam.
Thank you, Your Honour. The first topic that I want to start with is hydroelectricity generation. And if you turn the clock back to late yesterday afternoon, my friend Mr. Welsh asks you some questions in relation to the way in which Plan Change 7 operated with respect to the generation of hydroelectricity. He put to you some examples of what I would colloquially describe as the big schemes, the big run-of-river schemes. But can you do you have an understanding of the range of hydroelectricity generation schemes within the region?
Schemes or activities? Because, well, there's both, to my understanding. There are a number of smaller, privately owned hydroelectricity generation turbines, but then there's also a number of schemes spread out across the region. I am not an expert on this, but there are quite a few catchments, Roaring Meg, Earnscliffe, Manuharikia, Teviot River, Waipori scheme, all different scales. Clutha, sorry.
Insofar as you're aware, is the water that goes through some of those turbines taken and used for a range of purposes?
Yes. For example, the Fraser Dam and the Falls Dam. On the Manuharikia River. Both are schemes where the water is used for hydroelectricity power as well as for irrigation or a variety of other uses.
And so care would need to be taken in terms of how those applications are considered through the lens of Plan Change 7, that they're not just hydroelectricity uses.
Correct.
My friend Mr. Page put some questions to you today in relation to some of the risks associated with Plan Change 7 insofar as potential environmental enhancement might be delayed for a six-year period. There's nothing in Plan Change 7 that would preclude the primary sector making improvements, so there are no impediments to that occurring?
No.
Making improvements?
Yeah.
Sorry, what do you mean by that?
There are no improvements to environmental enhancement occurring.
Oh, as a voluntary action?
Yes.
No. There wouldn't be any...
No.
No, okay.
And then just A final question of clarification. I'm not sure I quite caught your response, but there was a discussion where you were encouraged to put yourself into the mindset of a roundhead galaxid, I think it was.
Pretty hard.
And you'd referred to Dr. Allibone's evidence, and I had understood that your recollection was that there was that the status quo did not present any risk to that population in terms of a risk of extinction. Did I understand that correctly?
Correct, and I can probably it's best that I just refer to the paragraph. Hopefully I can find it.
Perhaps paragraph 24 of his evidence in reply.
Evidence of reply?
Yes.
Yes. Correct. I think it's actually in a number of other paragraphs as well.
So what are you confirming there? Does that jog your memory as to that your memory or your recollection was correct?
No
risk of extinction?
Yeah.
Is it something else?
No. That's correct.
No risk of extinction?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you. No further questions.
Very good. Well, you'll be relieved to know the court has no questions, so you're released.
Thank you.
But we anticipate seeing you again. But you are released from your oath, so that means you can also talk to Mr. Moore and, and your team. Yeah, but thank you very much. It's been very helpful, but
I hope
very
so.
Long, I know, from your perspective as well. You've done really well.
I apologise for sometimes...
It's immensely stressful, and I get that, and it's exhausting, because we get that, with all that concentration. Yeah.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Time for a cup of tea? No? And then we can... No, not yet.
Good time to perhaps flag. There was a discussion this morning about the possibility of essentially having a panel of planning witnesses, and I guess my concern is that Mr. Brass and other planners have prepared evidence based on the plan changes notified.
I know.
We have moved on somewhat from that. We have the 4 March version, we're going to have another version. And I'm just really wondering about the utility of cross-examining planners on something which actually is no longer perhaps before the court. And so my suggestion is that perhaps we could explore the prospect of having a panel of the planners all together once they've had the opportunity to consider the further evidence that's to come in, and then perhaps as a way of short-circuiting
I suppose the answer is it depends on what comes out and whether there's general alignment as between the planners. I suspect there won't be alignment, across the planning sector, if I could put it that way. I think as for cross-examination on the council's hands or the party's hands, there may yet still be very good questions going to test the facts and assumptions that then go into, underpin this new document. So there might very well be legitimate reasons to cross-examine. Mm-hmm. So it depends, but I appreciate the initiative. And for everyone here, if your evidence is overtaken by subsequent development by the regional council, I think you just need to tell us that, and particularly if it's a deletion of evidence, so that we know that we don't have to take that into account, and then we're moving on from a different starting point or a different basis anyway. But we're open to it, and we'll just see how things lie when we see the product from the council.
Mm. Well, we do know that Mr. Moore is very good at running panels of planners.
Yes. Is that from Southland?
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. anyway, I just wanted to
we're open to that. Probably the only thing that has caused our ears to prick and might be complex, potentially complex, which is the issue that you've already raised, is the issue of priorities. And it's not just an evidential issue. I think it's the legal instrument issue as well, you know, because I understand these priorities, whilst recorded on a deemed permit, are effectively a licence as between, water permit users, which then are expunged, if you like, on the 1st of October, but which nevertheless the Minister had recommended come through. It's picked up in the Section 32, it seemed to be dropped actually. I think it is dropped in the plan change. For some reason, it's not clear to me where that is. And so, if it comes back in, then how does it come back in? What is it? Is it something that is enforceable by the council? Is it something as between the consent holders? That requires a lot of careful thought, and to which we can make no suggestions. That's complex, quite apart from the extent to which they're exercised and are redolent within the flows of, river flows now. And, of course, your witness makes the point, well, if they're exercised, there's a trace in the water metering anyway. So that's actually very, very complex. Mm. So you might not get anything tonight, I'm thinking, from the regional council. Yes. Yeah. But, that sort of thing, before we launch into cross-examination, launch into impanelling witnesses, possibly would warrant region putting up something, it being tested by the lawyers, and then redirecting that into a planning conference.
Mm. Right. No, thank you.
As opposed to, impanelling planners and, I don't know. This is now very, everything's in play with this plan. Yep. Okay, very good. We'll have afternoon tea and then we're in your hands, Ms. Winchester. Yep.
Thank you, Your Honour. And I might just signal in terms of timing. I'm hopeful that I can get through my submissions and get through my first witness, who is going to be Mr. Funga, who's travelled up from Southland with a number of supporters and, of course, is... there's also Mr. Bull and Ms. Thompson who wish to present. My understanding is that there's to be no cross-examination of Mr. Funga any longer. I may be incorrect about that assumption, in which case it could just proceed to
cross-examination.
Court questions, but I may just... Yep. I'm relaxed about that, but
okay.
my anxiety, ma'am, is about allowing Mr. Funga to finish tonight, and because a number of the people who have travelled up need to be back on the road this evening, so it would assist if we could do that. And so I won't... I'll get through my legal submissions as
quick. If we have to sit beyond five, and that's convenient to everybody, that's what we'll do.
Thank you, Your Honour.
Okay. All right. Thank you. All right. Cup of tea time anyway, 15 minutes. All rise.